And we are back. Thanks for sticking with us all day and all week here on Azure Week at the Virtual Academy. And we have with us now Rowan Miller, in fact, from the Entity Framework team.
Good to see you, Scott.
Good to see you, sir. Thanks for hanging out.
Very welcome.
So we're talking about web development. We're talking about Azure.
Yep.
A big part of that's data access. We did touch a little bit on Entity Framework when we were looking at Pranav sharing with us how the new entity, the new identity system.
Yep.
Is Entity Framework at its heart, which is pretty cool.
Absolutely, code first, yep.
One of the things that came up early on with Scott Hunter was the importance of async and await in everything that we do. So I'm really excited about hearing about that inside of Entity Framework.
Yeah,
we've as well as some of the new features.
That, so.
Let's do it.
Great. Cool, so a couple of slides to start with, and we're going to spend almost all our time writing code. So.
I like that.
So do I. Quick slide about me. I work as a program manager on the Entity Framework team here at Microsoft. You can catch my blog at rowmiller.com. Been on the EF team for about 5 years now. Started off as a tester, did that for 2 years, swapped to PM, I've been doing that for about 3 years now.
Cool.
Just wanted to set expectations for the session. We're not doing a 101 introduction to EF session. We're gonna start with some pretty technical content. The first demo is a little bit light on looking at the designer, and then we're gonna dig right into mocking and unit testing and things like that.
Awesome.
I've got a bit.ly bundle there. If you are new to EF and you want to get started, then head to that bit.ly bundle. A lot of great links there. And we'll also mention a few links throughout our talk, and I've included those in the bit.ly bundle too.
And we'll tweet those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, just a reminder too, you can get MVA points for this session, so follow the link there to sign up.
Let's do it.
Okay, so we're going to take a couple of slides to look at what's new in EF6, and then also 6.1, which is the release we're working on at the moment.
Okay.
Then, like I said, demos of a whole bunch of new features, including some stuff that's coming in 6.1. Nobody's really seen that yet. Even folks on our team haven't seen it. So we've got last night's build. We're trying out some stuff that started working about 11
hours
ago.
Nice, nice. So this is last night's build of 6.1?
Yep.
And 6.1, would you think of that as a spring release around build timeframe?
Yeah, think of it as just, around that time, some new features, nothing earth-shattering, but just a chance to ship a few things we've been working on.
All right, cool.
So coming up in EF6, which is already shipped now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these, but we enabled async and await keywords for database operations, so query and save. Connection resiliency is about retrying failed connections. So this is important even in the cloud when your database connection is more likely to drop out, or when you're targeting something like SQL Azure that has connection throttling in it. Code-based config is for folks like me who would rather write code than XML in their .config file. Database command interception is about getting in between EF as it talks to the database. You can log things, which we're actually going to look at in the demos, but you can actually also mess with the commands before they're sent to the database or even short circuit them and return results. Testability we're going to look at. We've made it easier to use frameworks such as mock to test with EF. All that stuff applies whether you're using code first or the EF designer. But then there's a couple of features that only apply if you're modeling with code first. So custom conventions is about adding to the way EF interprets your classes to work out what the database is going to look like. And then we allow mapping to insert, update, and delete store procedures. Say that's code first only. We've actually supported that in the EF designer for quite a while now.
It's new to code first.
New to code first, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going to go through this slide, but in addition to those big features, there's a whole bunch of other stuff we included as well. Some from the EF team, but at the start of EF6, we actually went open source. So we took a bunch of contributions, took 25 in total for EF6, including some small features, which are listed there for you to look at. Contributors are going great. Actually, in EF6.1, we've already had 22 contributions we've accepted. So
was that a weird transition?
It is, yeah.
You went from having just the team, and the amount of work you could get done was the amount of work that the team could accomplish.
Absolutely.
And now you've got this extra team.
Yeah. I mean, one really good example of that is SQL Compact is something our team was having a hard time really focusing on. Mm-hmm. We supported it, but we couldn't do all the new and greatest stuff for SQL Compact. But one of our MVPs has actually contributed a whole bunch of stuff for SQL Compact. So, you know,
it's great.
See some great stuff coming there. And then coming in 6.1, so alpha is out for 6.1 at the moment. It's just the runtime, not the tooling. The beta will be coming out in the coming weeks, and then we'll be shipping, like you said, kind of spring timeframe.
Cool.
One focus here was trying to clear our backlog of all the medium and high priority bugs. So we've got 113 bug fixes so far and counting, a few more still going in. Tooling consolidation we're going to look at, that's about similar to the one ASP.NET effort where we tried to simplify how you create a new project. In EF, we're trying to make it simpler how you create a new model. Instead of having different tools for different things, we just have one set of tooling. Transaction commit failure, I'll actually demo that, so we'll talk about it when we get there.
Cool.
Public mapping API gives you the information we have about how the classes map to the database. We've had this forever, it was just never public. Heaps of people wanted it, so we basically tidied up the API and made it public. DB configuration extensibility is just making it easier for third-party frameworks like Glimpse to hook in underneath EF. And then in Code First, we're going to support the index attribute. So you can put index on a property, and then we'll turn that into an index in the database.
Nice, nice change.
Cool. Enough of slides.
And that's, it's all demos now.
It's all demos.
Yay, we made it.
Got 43 minutes of demos. So I bought a ton of demos. We're just going to see what we get through. So
let's do it.
All right. So the first
we did point out this is not a 101 level because there's a lot of 101 content up there.
Absolutely.
Right. You can go up to ASP.NET/entity-framework or click in the solutions drop down, and there's piles and piles of great documentation on the basics of entity framework.
And like I said too, that Bitly bundle has like the highest priority links you should go check out if you're new as well. In addition to some more advanced ones we're going to cover in this talk today.
Great.
So it's not 101. This first demo isn't super technical, so if you're looking forward to the real deep 400 level stuff, just hold your horses for 1 second. But this is something that started working about 11 hours ago, so most of the EF team has...
This is a preview of what's coming in the spring.
Absolutely, yep.
That's great, and it's freaking January, which is awesome.
Okay, so for this demo, we're going to be working with the AdventureWorks database.
I thought you were like, you're going to show me something with one table.
No.
You've brought something with a scroll bar and a pile of tables.
Yeah, so this is a little bit more realistic. You know, folks don't have blog posts and tags, right? They have...
They don't? That's not the sum total of all?
We could almost ship that in VS, right? So AdventureWorks has 73 tables in it and a bunch of views too. So
a lot of work.
Reasonable size. So I want to target AdventureWorks using Code First. In the past, I had two options. I either handwrite a whole bunch of classes, or I go, and if I'm lucky, I know that the EF Power Tools exist. I can go and download those. But if you wanted to work with the EF Designer in the past, you probably would have right-clicked on your models folder, said you wanted to add a new item. You would have selected the A.NET Entity Data Model, given it a name. And then we've actually got some new options in here. So these two have been around for a while. We have EF Designer from the database and an empty EF Designer model. But we've introduced these new ones for Code First as well. So you can think, you can create an empty Code First model. Now, of course, you're always free to just go write a Code First model yourself from scratch if you want to. This will just kind of get you started with some basic code. But the new one is Code First from an existing database. So we're going to select that. I've worked with AdventureWorks already, so VS kind of knows about it in the connections, but I could hit new connection, enter whatever database I want. This is exactly the same wizard we have for the designer. So on the next screen, we get to pick what we want to include in the model.
Nice.
So there's a bunch of views, a bunch of tables too, all kind of grouped by schema here. We don't want these ones. They don't really apply to our model, so we'll just get rid of those. So we're going to be pulling 70 tables into our model. So it's going to chug away and think for a little bit. It's actually using the same reverse engineer components the designer uses. So it's going to calculate a model based on the database. It's going to pull that into memory, and then it's going to write out a whole bunch of code for us instead of writing it out to an XML or EDMX file. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to quickly walk through the code that's generated. One thing we really tried to do is make the code as close as possible to what somebody would write by hand.
So what you would call idiomatic code first.
Yeah, you know, there's not like a whole bunch of...
It doesn't look generated.
Redundant using statements and
right.
a whole bunch of junk everywhere. In fact, we don't want to mark this code as auto-generated because we actually want people to own this code.
Ah,
so this is scaffolded code.
That's a good point. So you're not; these are not all, you know, whatever .g .cs.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're not scary. And I noticed that there's no comments at the top saying, don't touch this.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is a jump start. Like you said, it's a scaffold.
Yep, exactly. And we'll walk through a couple of them quickly. So a very simple DB context class. It has, you know, DB set properties. For us, there's 70 of them because it was a pretty big model.
Right.
Folks get a little bit stumped on this syntax. This is just telling Code First that it should definitely get the connection string for this context from the config file. So this means if I happen to do something else and use the context where my config file wasn't present,
right.
Code First isn't going to kick in and magically just pick some database and create it for me. It's going to fail and say, hey, I need the connection string from the config file. Now, let's pick on department because we're going to be looking at that a bit today. So we just scaffold simple stuff. Where possible, we use data annotations.
Well, it's nice that, you have a human resources dot department, but you've made the class called department.
Exactly, yeah. trying to keep it similar to what people would write. We only put annotations where we need to. So if this class happened to be mapping to a table called dbo.departments, that's what Code First would work out by default anyway, so we wouldn't bother sticking the annotation.
Mm-hmm. And you brought all of the restrictions in, all of the extra data types, and string length, all those things. They're all here.
Now, this is important too, right, because MVC will validate this for you, so it's useful to have it there.
Well, is it true now that this is going to become, if it has not already become, the authoritative source for knowledge of the database? If I'm going to start using this for migrations...
Yeah, so if we have time, we're actually going to go into that. So if we don't have time, there's a link in the Bitly bundle talking about migrations to an existing database, but we've actually done some work to make it easier to kind of bootstrap migrations and then start work.
Cool.
So the last thing I wanted to call out, some things you can't do with the data annotations. So if we scroll down, we'll find an on-model creating method in here. And we have some configuration that's done using the Fluent API.
Oh, okay. So a department has many employee department histories.
Yep. So the reason we had to configure this is because it's a required relationship, but cascade delete is off. So we needed to tell Code First, configure the relationship and set cascade delete off.
Otherwise the relationship would be inferred.
Yes, as cascade delete on, and then you get different behavior in memory than you would get in the database.
Nice.
And we do some other things here. There's no way in the data annotations to say that a string property is a fixed length. So we do that here too.
Mm.
Okay, so we've built the model. I'm just going to quickly build and then we'll scaffold a controller just to prove that everything works. So nothing new here. This is the stuff that's been in MVC for a while. Okay, so it takes a second to scaffold. One thing I wanted to point out with the code that gets generated, obviously we scaffold the code and you're free to edit it, but in addition to that, it actually uses T4 templates to do the generation. So if you wanted to get our T4 templates and drop them into your project, which we'll have a NuGet package for, then you can tweak the code that gets generated. Ah. So maybe you want to, get rid of the partial and everything. You want everything.
Well, and this gets to sealed. The control, right?
Exactly.
You're removing more black boxes.
Yep. Yeah, we use T4. If you want to edit them, go for it.
Cool.
Yep. Okay, so nothing groundbreaking here. A standard MVC controller wired up to already use EF. There'll be a little bit of a pause here. Code First actually does a whole bunch of checks when it first connects to a database. It's possible to switch these off. So that's probably what we'll actually do once we finish this reverse engineer Code First is wire up the model so that they're switched off. But like I said, this worked end-to-end for the last time last night. So
there's all the departments.
Yep. So we're hooked up to the database. Minimal effort, and now I'm free to go edit my Code First model.
Nice job.
Cool. All right, so to make editing easy, we're asked to show a slide between each demo, so here's our slide. Next thing I wanted to look at was dependency resolution. This is something we kind of introduced in EF6, but we haven't really showed it that much on stage or anything. So let's go back to my VM. So one of the reasons folks would want to use dependency resolution or inversion of control or any of those names for the same thing, is to get rid of hidden dependencies that objects have. So this department's controller is dependent on an AdventureWorks context, but at the moment it's hidden because it just constructs it itself. That's going to make it really hard to unit test because I have no way of injecting a different context to use. So I'm going to get rid of that just by adding a new constructor. I'm going to use code snippets because you don't want to watch me type a whole bunch of code. So now we're making the dependency explicit because I have to pass it into the constructor. Now, it's not going to work with MVC because MVC needs a default constructor. So that's a great opportunity to use an inversion of control container. So AutoFac's a really popular one. So let's install AutoFac with MVC5 integration. And then we're just going to wire a few things up in global.asax. So we use AutoFac. So a couple of usings, and then I'll pull in a magical code snippet again. Set up AutoFac.
All right, let's just take a second and give a look.
So let's work through what we've done here.
So if you wouldn't mind, just go back to Departments Controller.
Yep.
So right now, if you ran this and you went to Departments, MVC would be like, I have no way to make one of these.
Yeah, we'll give you an exception saying there's no constructor that I can use on Departments Controller because MVC really only knows about the empty default constructor.
Right. And AutoFac is going to be able to go and provide that factory of objects. Right?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so it'll know how to make one.
Yep, so let's walk through that code quickly. So AutoFac kind of revolves around this idea of a container. So we create a container, and then we use this extension method, which is handy, just to go and register all the MVC controllers. So this means AutoFac knows how to, or knows about all the controllers we have in our solution, including departments controller. Mm-hmm. Now we know that one of the dependencies the controllers have is the AdventureWorks context. So AutoFac's smart, it will look at the constructors and work out that there's one that uses the AdventureWorks context. So provided we tell AutoFac how to create the context, it'll go ahead and pass it into the constructor. And then this line of code here is telling MVC to use AutoFac to resolve its dependencies.
So you went and got the AutoFac MVC5 integration.
Exactly, yep.
That's AutoFac, that's the MVC5 integration.
Exactly, so they have a built-in implementation of iDependency Resolver, which is part of MVC, which allows MVC to be able to talk to AutoFac to find its dependencies.
Lovely.
So when it wants the departments control, it's going to talk through the iDependency Resolver, which will talk to AutoFac, which will give back the controllers.
Cool.
Now, what would be great is if we could wire that up to EF as well. Now, unfortunately, there's not an AutoFac.EF integration package at the moment, but I have this handy-dandy code snippet to define an EF resolver that results from AutoFac.
Totally obvious snippet. I would have written that myself.
Just to be clear, these don't ship in VS. You have to create your own snippets file for these.
Okay, so IDB dependency resolver is the EF dependency resolver interface.
Exactly. So you can register one of these with EF, and then EF will use it to get the services it needs. So simple constructor that takes in the AutoFac container we created, and then basically two methods, same as the ASP.NET one, to get service and to get services. Now, you'll notice in here I'm not doing anything with lifetimes. You know, in ASP.NET, we typically use an instance per request pattern. But EF really only supports two patterns. It has singleton, which means it's going to use the same instance of the service for the whole app domain.
Right.
These are things like database interceptors. We just register once for performance reasons and reuse it for the whole app domain. The other situation is we use once and throw away. So examples of this execution strategies. We're going to ask the dependency resolver for one, and then we're going to throw it away. And we're going to ask the dependency resolver for another one. So in those cases, you don't register an instance and execution strategy. You register a factory to allow EF to create them.
Is there some way or reason that you would have maybe wanted to have used the same dependency resolver or one that was generic? Did you need to make an IDB dependency resolver?
We wanted to. So what would have been good in hindsight would be for ASP.NET and EF to share one. Because we have the same interface with different names and different assemblies.
But you want to be able to use EF anywhere else, though, too.
Exactly, yeah. So we don't want to take a dependency on MVC.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I hope in the future we converge on something, but for the moment, these technologies have their own things.
Indeed.
Okay, so now all we need to do is wire this up. Now, unfortunately, it's not quite as easy as MVC, but we do db configuration.load, and I'll talk about why it's not as easy in a second. So I'm going to write one of these magic things that I know you love.
Yeah. Rocket ship Anders.
Yep. So we're going to add a dependency resolver. So the loaded event on DB configuration says after EF has calculated all its other config, it gives us this hook to go and add extra dependency resolvers in. So we're going to create an instance of our AutoFac DB dependency resolver, which requires our AutoFac container. Now there's one other parameter required here, which is a parameter that identifies whether this is going to override configuration done in the config file.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to do that. If I deploy this application and decide I want to change something, I want to be able to go to web.config and change it.
Indeed.
Yep. Okay, so we're wired up. EF's going to use AutoFac for dependencies. Now, one of the reasons we add it instead of setting the dependency resolver is if the dependency resolver doesn't have a dependency, then it's going to fall back to the default EF one and pick up the dependency there. So even though I haven't registered anything with AutoFac, EF's still going to work because it's going to try AutoFac. It's not going to give it anything. So then it's going to fall back to its default one that we ship to get its dependencies.
Would there be any value in having a static class dbDependencyResolver.AddResolver?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just from a be easier syntactic than sugar
trying to work out how to write this stuff. Yeah, for sure. So like I said, it's not actually doing anything at the moment. So let's look at an example of registering a dependency. So I thought
what kind of dependencies would EF have?
So that's a good question. So one of the ones I mentioned was the hook before and after we send commands to the database. Mm-hmm. So let's look at wiring that up to a logging framework. So we like third-party frameworks, so let's pull in nlog. I'll pull in the one that wires up all the configuration for me. So that's their nlog.config package. Drops an nlog.config file in, and I'm just going to uncomment the defaults. So this is just going to write everything out to a text file for me. Okay, so then we need to write an interceptor that will delegate to nlog to do logging.
And our goal here is to tell Entity Framework about this logging system so that anytime something happens before and after, it'll tell nlog.
Yep.
So it's almost like aspect-oriented programming.
Exactly.
We're using the dependency injection system to do it.
Yeah, so this class here is an interceptor that we can pass to EF and say every time before and after, you're going to go through these methods on the way back and forwards.
IDB command interceptor, that's an Entity Framework thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is the nlog implementation of it, which appears to be pretty much nothing right now.
Yeah.
You've basically, you could have written it, implemented it. There's that first line where you make your class logger.
Yep, so this is the logger we're going to log to.
Okay.
And then basically we're not doing anything before, but afterwards I'm calling this helper method I've got to log the command completed. So if we scroll down and look at that, and these methods here mimic what's on DB command. So there's a non-query method on there, so execute non-query. So we have the executing and executed that happened before and after.
Oh, I see. For things like non-queries, like inserts and things.
Yep. And then we have readers and scalers are the other two options.
Gotcha.
And then if it comes back, if it's successful, we just log the text that we sent to the database. And if it wasn't successful, we just warn the fact that it failed and write the exception out. So now the next thing we need to do is actually wire this up. So we could do this using EF's code-based config, but it'd be better to do it with AutoFact for us.
Because ultimately, if you're building a large-scale system and you're using lots of different things, you're going to want to have your AutoFact, your IOC container, handling all these things.
Exactly.
In one place.
Yeah. So I'm saying I want to register an IDB interceptor. So that's the type that EF is going to ask for. And when I do that, I want to return our new instance of our nlog interceptor. Make sense?
Nice.
Cool. So let's go ahead and run. We'll hit the departments first, and then once we've done that, we'll just navigate around a bit to hit a few other things.
And this is just going into a text file, it looks like, in the logs folder.
Yep, exactly. So we'll look at that in a second. So let's just navigate and then go back to the list, say.
And is this going to show me the SQL that was used as well?
Yep, absolutely. So we'll just open our... Oops, that's not what I wanted to do. Let's reload that project. We want to open it in File Explorer. We'll see we now have a logs folder here. And I can open it up, and here's all the SQL being sent to the database.
Nice. And see, like you mentioned before, the Glimpse folks.
Yeah, exactly.
This is going to be perfect for them.
Yep.
They're finally going to have a place to jump in a non-invasive way.
Yep.
Without doing any hacks.
Yeah, so there's two things here. One we didn't look at is the simple .log property on context.database. So that allows you just to have a human-readable log format that you can spit to the console or the output window or whatever. But this is good if you want to run code. So for Glimpse, if they want to do some timing before and after, then they can do that. Now, if they want to, you know, track what request the thing is part of, then they can wire all that up as well.
We talked to Scott Hunter at the beginning of the morning, and he talked about his kind of larger goal of making the tracing and diagnostics information tidy, because we've got amazing tracing, you know, buried in Web API.
Yep.
We've got now the ability to have trace logs and streaming logs coming from Azure.
Yep.
Would does this go out to trace automatically, or would I write a tracing?
You would write something. So by default, we don't register these because they can, depending on what they do, have a reasonable performance impact.
Sure.
Obviously, EF sends a lot of commands to the database. So by default, they're off. One thing we have talked about doing is perhaps having an ETW one, so event tracing for Windows, because that has a very low overhead if it's not configured to be used.
Nice.
So, or at least the ability to flick it on with a config switch. So one thing to call out here, we kind of see the queries that we sent to the database. So these were explicitly sent from us navigating around. But I also mentioned that EF does a whole bunch of checking when it first warms up. So we see things like querying the EDM metadata table and the migrations history table. So we actually see everything that EF's doing, not just what our application's doing.
So here you're making sure that you're going to be successful with this code-first model.
Yeah, what we're basically doing is trying to work out whether this is a database that CodeFirst owns. Mm. And if it is, we can check whether it's in sync with the model and stuff. Now, in this case, it's not. So these commands all fail. And so this is the kind of stuff we could switch off to get better warm-up performance. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the dependency resolution section.
Nice.
Let's just hop back and hit our next slide. So I wanted to quickly talk about configuring for SQL Azure, because this is something that folks want to do these days. Mm. So we have some built-in stuff in EF to help with that. So I'm going to go back over to global.asax, where we wired up our dependencies. And then I've got this other handy code snippet. So there's two things I'm registering here. One is an execution strategy, and this allows us to insert some logic whenever we send a command to the database. So we're wiring up the default SQL Azure execution strategy, which has some sensible defaults. It knows which exceptions can be retried from SQL Azure, has sensible defaults about how many times to retry, the pause between retries, and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the transaction handler, because it's more likely to drop a connection, that's usually fine, but the problem is if we're doing a transaction commit at the time, we get an exception, we have no idea whether the transaction was actually committed in the database or not.
Mm-hmm.
So you can wire up this commit failure handler, and this will create some extra logging tables in the database so that if there's an exception during commit, we can then reconnect to the database, check that log, and see whether the transaction actually successfully committed or not.
Now, forgive my ignorance, but why are these func of type while these other ones were just types?
Yeah, so remember we talked about the DB interceptor is like a singleton pattern.
Right.
So this happens, gets configured once, and EF just reuses it for the whole thing.
Right.
These ones are like one use and then throw away pattern.
I see. So here you're saying make a new one, that's the one forever,
yep.
And here's the funk that's going to make new ones all the time.
Yeah.
This is a factory.
Yeah. So it's a factory. We kind of ummed and ahed, should we have interface factories? So should we have execution strategy factory and transaction handler factory? Or should we just use funks? Funks are kind of nice and consistent. They're a little bit less discoverable.
I think it's the double hash rockets that confuse people.
Yeah.
The anders, double anders.
And especially these, like, you know, multiple funk to funk off.
That's non-trivial.
Yeah.
But it is what it is.
Yeah. And again, most people will be setting these up using code-based config, so you're not registering funks of things. You just say set execution strategy.
Right, but this is showing us how it plugs into a container where this container happens to be autofac.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just going to run the app. We'll do something quickly that's going to cause a transaction to be opened. Folks often ask, what do I have to do with EF to get transactions? The answer is nothing. EF uses transactions by default.
Really? So they're getting transactions and they didn't even know it?
Yeah. So if I loaded up my page, we're just going to edit one of these quickly. We'll save it. So EF does this save within a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
So if I then go over to SQL Management Studio and just refresh the tables, we'll see that EF has created this transactions table here, which is what it's using just to keep a state of what transactions have been committed. Then if there's an exception, we can query it and find out whether it failed or succeeded. Make sense?
Yep.
Great.
It's funny, I remember 95 when this was really hard.
Yeah. And it's
dealing with transactions. And
yeah, it's still kind of hard. That's why we went and wrote something to do it for you.
Indeed.
All right, so next demo, testability improvements. So you've been able to test with EF for a while now, but it often involved using interfaces and writing a whole bunch of code to make it work. So what we're going to look at now is using mock to test the department's controller. So remember, we updated the department's controller so that we pass in an instance of the context we're going to use.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to use mock, so I'm going to install the mock package. And then I've kind of stubbed out this test already. We're going to go through and implement it.
Gotcha.
So the first thing we want to do, again, lots of code snippets here, but I'll walk through each one as we do it. So this one is just about creating some in-memory data. So we're writing a test to make sure that when we call the index method on department's controller, that the data that comes back is ordered by name.
Okay.
So our test data is explicitly not ordered by name. Now it's time to start using mock. So this is what you couldn't do in the past. You couldn't mock a DB set directly. You would have had to start using IDB set and then writing a whole bunch of code to have a fake implementation of it. So obviously with mock, we need to implement just the stuff that our test is actually going to use.
Now, in this case, just to mince words a minute,
yeah.
We're effectively testing DBSet, but specifically we're testing department within a DBSet.
Yeah, so we're actually not going to be testing DBSet.
Okay,
I mean,
good.
The EF team tests that.
Yeah,
we're going to test
sure.
the department's controller by passing in a mocked instance of the context. Now, the only thing on the context that the department's controller touches is the DBSet. So we're mocking the DBSet as well.
Mm, okay, so when the controller goes and it accesses the database.
Exactly.
Which isn't a database, it's a DBSet.
Yep.
We're going to fake it out.
Yep, and it's going to fall back to our list up here that we've
And never touch the database.
Exactly.
Now I understand.
All right, so this is an ugly bit of code. Again, there's just a link in the bit.ly bundle or on our msdn/data/EF. This is standard code you have to write to wire up link.
This is because this is how mock works?
Yeah, so EF, when it tries to query DBSet, which is going to happen in the index controller, it's going to use link. And so link, basically, iQueryable has these four properties, or three properties and a method on the iQueryable interface that it's going to try and use. Now, all we're basically doing is saying, instead of using the EF provider, fall back to the provider from the list. So we're going to use link to objects instead. So this is basically the plumbing to say, don't use EF's implementation, fall back to the list implementation.
You're saying set it up such that we're not going to use the default provider, use that provider and that one. That's one of those things where someone, you or Mark, or someone's going to have to figure out a way to make that look like one line.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually thinking we should ship a NuGet package with all this stuff in.
Yeah, would work too. Make an ef.mock.sample.
Yep. So the next thing we do, we actually need to pass a context in. So we just quickly set up a mock of the AdventureWorks context, and we're just setting up the department's property to return our mock DB set.
And you got a lot of fantastic code here. Would you make the entire AdventureWorks thing that you've done here available to us?
Yeah, it actually already is. So there's a link at the end. It's all up on GitHub, and I've put tags at each after the end of each demo.
On whose GitHub?
Mine. So there's a link to it at the end.
All right, great.
Yep. So now that we've got everything mocked, we can run the test. So we just create an instance of our controller, pass in the mocked context, and get the result from calling index.
And the result, presumably, then, would be a list of departments, which is going to be A, B, A, 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 B, 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 B.
Yeah, so it's an
having
action
never
result.
Hit the database.
Yeah, exactly.
Love it.
So the next thing we need to do, obviously, test need to verify. So we're going to check if everything worked.
Okay, and then the world exploded.
Yeah. So I'm doing some simple checking here.
I have to say that you get the award for the day for best use of snippets.
Yeah.
It's pretty special.
Cool. So the first thing we're doing here is checking. So the index by default returns an action result, but we need a view result because we expect data to be in there. So we check that that happened.
Indeed.
We then check that the view result has an enumerable of departments in it. And we then just go down and check that they're in order. So we check that the first one's AAA, the second one's BBB, and the third one's CCC.
I see.
All right. Don't get too hung up on this. It's just,
no. It's something for you to have tested.
Exactly, yeah. So we're going to run the test. Don't stress. I expect this one to fail. And it fails, and we see that our verification failed. It expected the first one to be AAA, but the first one's actually CCC. And that's just because we haven't actually implemented sorting in our index method yet. So just to prove that this is a legitimate unit test.
Well, dude, you got to fail fast, fail first. I love it.
We're just going to add in sort by department.name.
Group by or?
Order by is actually what I want. Order by.
Okay. And hang on. This is a 2013-ism here. You see that?
Yep.
That's great. Pretty cool, it's showing you that it didn't work out before.
Yep. It's also showing us that we used this constructor for the test as well, which is nice.
That is nice. I never seen that.
So let's run the failed test again, and this time, after a short pause, it should run and pass.
That's cool.
Got a legit unit test that's actually testing without hitting the database. Now, we know it's not hitting the database because I don't have the connection strings in the app.config, so if it was trying to hit a database, it would fail.
And forgive me, this was 6 or 6.1?
So most of what we showed so far is 6. The first demo we did where we reverse engineered code first, that was 6.1.
Okay, so that means that people can today go and tidy up their tests and start using mock in a more thoughtful way, mocking their databases.
Exactly.
Now.
Yep. And I've actually included a walkthrough with all this code in it in the Bitly bundle as well.
Brilliant. So, right. I'm actually going to make a better URL for that Bitly bundle. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it is. But you know, type that nasty thing in once. Okay, so you wanted to talk about async.
I love async. It's a joy.
It is. It's also very confusing. I think if you're anything like me, when I first heard async, I was like, oh, parallelism. I can throw two queries at the database at the same time and have them come back and save me some time. And that's, you can do parallelism with async, but it's not really what async's about. So maybe we can walk through making this method async and just kind of talk about the words as we
put them in. And it's going to be async all the way down.
Yep. So we're going to throw async on it. Async just telling the compiler that this method is going to return before it's actually finished executing. Now, at some point, that means the current thread can go do something else. And then at some point, this method's going to need some time from the CPU on managed threads again. So it's going to have to load back up the method and finish executing it. Now, obviously, because it returns before it's finished, we can't return the action result because we don't know what the result actually is. So instead, we have to return a task of action result. So this task just allows anyone calling it to monitor and know when it's finished and then go and get the result. Now, we said we wanted to do an async database query, so let's swap this one to be to list async.
And is in every example, is there an async. It looks like you've got two array async. So
anything first, you could do before. First or default, all that stuff.
Nice.
Now, these are extension methods in EF.
So, you can see that they're extension methods because of the little arrow pointing down there.
Now, most link extension methods are in the system.link namespace. Mm-hmm. These ones you'll need to have system data entity imported to be able to use. Okay. So that's a common gotcha.
Because they're yours.
Yeah, we didn't want to like pollute the link namespace in case we ever end up with a real set of async methods in link.
Makes sense.
Cool. Now, toList async, of course, because it's async, is going to return before it's finished. So if we look at the return type on this, we'll see that it's a task of a list of departments. But that's not what we want to pass into our view. Mm. So we can now use the await keyword, which is going to say, at this point, my index method is going to return. And then when this toList async has finished evaluating, come back and continue on with my method from where it came back. So everything on the right is going to be executed and pause, and then the thread's going to come back, or even a different thread is going to load up my method and finish once we have the result.
And Scott Hunter was saying that if you had a bunch of really basic pages, even static pages, basic pages in ASP.NET, and then one really DB-heavy page, we're not using async on that. If enough people beat on that page, it could starve the request threads and prevent even the basic page getting requested, which he said means everyone should be using async anytime that they hit the database or the file system if they can.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. So in terms of an individual request coming in, it's not going to be quicker because even though we're not locking the current thread while we go to the database, this request can't complete until that call comes back. So if we lined up everything over time, we end up still with the same amount of time, or perhaps even a fraction more time because we have to hop threads.
Right.
Where it starts to pay off, because that thread is freed up, it can go process other requests.
Exactly. This is not about it's going to get magically faster.
Yeah.
It's about you stop to pick up the birthday cake. It's not ready. Come back in 20 minutes.
Exactly. Go do your other shopping.
That's all it is.
Yeah. And so an important thing to call out here, if you have a site that every page hits the same database, you're probably not really going to see that much increase in throughput because everything's going to end up locked on the database anyway.
Nice.
If you have a site that is a mixture of dynamic content that hits a database, but also some static content like a contact page or an index.htm or something, the requests are going to be freed up, the threads are going to be freed up to go and process those requests for static content super quick.
Right.
So I actually demoed this. There's a link in the Bitly bundle to an async talk I did at TechEd. We actually did a demo with some load tests hitting a site that was a mixture of dynamic and static. And you see the request time for the dynamic content's about the same.
Right.
But you see hundreds of tiny little requests for static content in the middle. So.
There was a question from an audience member about where this one reference is coming from.
Yep.
So that's actually built into 2013.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not an extension. That's part of the value that we give you when you upgrade to 2013.
Exactly. On my box, I'm standard VS 2013 with the latest EF bits, both runtime and tooling installed.
You have no extensions running?
Yep, no, nothing at all.
Cool. Although your use of Zoom In is really skillful.
Very good.
As a previous Zoom In user myself, I doffed my hat to you, sir.
All right, so one thing I do want to call out, we're not going to dig into how to fix this now, but our unit test now has a compilation error.
Because we switched to async.
Yep, so our index method is returning a task of action result, but we actually want the action result to verify. So I don't really care about async in our test method, so I'm just going to do dot result. It's going to block.
Yeah, you're not really supposed to do that. And everyone I've ever talked to said that's a bad idea.
Yeah, well, you could make this method async too if you wanted to.
Yeah, but
whatever. Now, if I ran this test, it would actually fail at the moment. I'm not going to write the code here. You have to do a bit more setup within mock to make async queries work against EF.
Oh, okay.
Because instead of using the iQueryable provider, we have kind of our own implementation of an IDB async provider. And it's a bit of code, but you copy-paste it from our site, or hopefully in the future, download it in the NuGet package, and you're good to go.
Cool. So,
the example code I have up in GitHub has that all stubbed out for you if you want to see it in action.
And your GitHub name is Romil.
Rowan Miller.
Rowan, full name.
But I've got the link in a slide at the end, so you'll be good. What have we got? I've probably got time for one more. So we talked about migrations with an existing database. So let's take a quick look at that. So I'll just hop back over to my VM. Got a bit lost there. Just going to close things down. So We're going to look at enabling migrations. Before I do that, just because these are pre-release bits, I'm actually going to upgrade to a later version of 6.1. This is one that isn't published yet.
Okay, so now we're going into daily build territory.
Yeah, so the one I have at the moment installed is 6.1.0 alpha 1.
And that is live out in the world right now?
Yep, so you can get that on NuGet.
Okay.
But I'm going to install a local update I have, which is actually beta 1. And it's not the final build of beta 1, it's last night's build. So we'll install that. Again, you don't need 6.1 to do this. You can do what I'm about to do with 6. There's just some bugs in 6.1.0 alpha 1. So. All right, so we're going to enable migrations is the first thing we're going to do. I'm going to get an error when I do this because we actually have two code first contexts in our project. The one we built, but we also talked identity also uses code first. So migrations are saying, which one do you want to enable migrations for? It's a nice error message that gives us the two commands we might be wanting to run. It's like Clippy. Where are you looking to?
Hopefully never like Clippy.
So we want to enable migrations for the AdventureWorks context.
Right.
All I did there, I deleted the fully qualified. You can fully qualify or not. If you're typing by hand, you'd probably write it more like this.
Okay.
That's going to enable migrations.
So you're enabling migrations for these 72 tables we brought in.
Yeah, so actually all at the moment it's doing is kind of scaffolding some stuff in my project to make migrations be able to work.
Hmm.
Now we're going to look at what does it look like to actually start using migrations against that database. Now there's two options here, and that is what do I want as the starting point where migrations is going to kick in? Do I want it to be an empty database so that if someone on another team or I deploy to production isn't going to have a database, they can run my migrations and get everything created from scratch.
Okay.
The other option, which is more likely, is that the current database I have is kind of the baseline that everybody has. So I want to treat that as the baseline and keep going from there on.
I see. Sense. So there's the from an empty database to now.
Yep.
Or there's the from now and all future points.
Exactly.
And I see that a migrations folder appeared over in your solution.
Oh, yeah. So I should quickly point out here, all it did was give us a migrations folder, and all that's in there is a migrations configuration class, which basically is just some settings that we can change if we want to.
All right.
So now we're going to go and add our first migration, and we're going to call this one Bootstrap. We can call it anything I want, but this is kind of the Bootstrap migration to get going.
Yep.
Now, if I ran this, the way migrations works is it looks at what the model looked like when the last migration was scaffolded. There isn't one, so that would be an empty model.
Right.
It looks at what the model looks like now, which is everything with our 70-odd tables in it. And it generates a migration for those. Now, that's not actually what we want. We don't want any changes at the moment. We just want to kind of record the current model as a snapshot starting point. This is really hard to explain. It's something we need to do better in EF. So I actually have a link in the Bitly bundle, but also up on our MSDN site that kind of walks through with some diagrams how migrations works. And it maybe takes 10 minutes to read through, grab a cup of coffee, and then once you've got those things, you'll be good for migrations against an existing database and also migrations in a team environment.
You know what you ought to do is get one of those artists that like draws stuff and they could animate a little YouTube video. So you just explain it and we'll get someone who knows how to draw, do the boxes and lines.
Perfect.
Put it on YouTube with a little music.
Yep.
A little ukulele. If we know somebody.
Some calming, soothing music.
We'll make it happen.
All right, so we're going to add a migration Bootstrap. I'm saying ignore changes, which means even though it's going to detect that there are changes in the model, I want it to ignore them and generate an empty migration for me. So all we're doing with this initial migration is we're basically generating a migration that does nothing, but it has the current snapshot of the model stored as the starting point.
Yeah, I don't think it would be difficult to know that that's what ignore changes meant.
Exactly.
To figure this out.
Yeah, that's unfortunately why we need docs, and if you need docs to explain a feature, then it's too hard to use. Yeah, totally agree with you. So we use update database. It's going to push our Bootstrap migration to the database, which is
the nothing.
Nothing. What it's effectively doing is creating the migrations history table, and that's basically it.
Mm.
So our database is now bootstrapped and ready to do migrations. So let's make a change to our model now. So we're going to pick on the department class again. We're starting to get audited, and each department's going to get a rating.
Didn't we get rid of that?
Maybe here, not at AdventureWorks. So it's comparing that snapshot that we took in the Bootstrap migration to the current model. It's going to see that we added a rating property, which in turn means we need to scaffold a rating column in the database, or add a rating column to the database.
Mm-hmm.
It's a non-nullable column. It's going to default to the CLR default for the property type, which would be 0. It's not a very good rating, so let's give them a default value of 3 perhaps. And then we'll run update database.
So you change the migration.
Yeah, again, this
directly.
Is a point, like this is scaffolded code. So you're free to edit this. You know, it's not a designer.cs file. It's just go for it. Here's what we think the changes are to your database. If you wanted to add extra columns or create indexes or something in here, you're free to edit it and put in what you want.
Cool.
So we'll run that one against the database. Another handy tip, if you're not sure what migrations is doing, you can pass the dash verbose flag to any of these commands and it will give you a log.
Okay.
Update database will actually show you the SQL we're running. So we'll just select the data from there. We'll zoom in, we'll see our rating column with a default value of 3 for everybody.
Nice.
Okay. Complicated demo. I wouldn't expect that you have a fantastic grasp of migrations to an existing database over that. Takeaway is that it's possible. And go read the document.
I think in the past, I know personally, and I've bugged you about this, I've had trouble where I've gotten myself into a weird state where I'm pretty sure my model looks okay and I thought I had migration set up, but I'll run it and I'll get a yellow screen of death that says that you suck and you think your database is right, but it's wrong. And it's just very helpless feeling. What was that was happening, and is that going to get better?
Yeah, we're definitely looking at ways to make it better now. Unfortunately, it's a really hard problem. What's happening is it's the fact that EF is taking a snapshot of the model and putting it in the migration. So if anything happens and they get out of sync, which is really common in team environments, you basically need to do the equivalent of a merge in source control to get it.
Yeah, like a resync.
Yeah.
Just like pick. I'd like to be able to pick the authoritative source.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose any data.
Yeah, exactly.
And figure it out.
So we're looking at some things very similar to source control, like you know merge and squash and all that stuff for migrations, which would help that problem. For the moment, unfortunately, you need to go read the doc and kind of grok up here what migrations is doing under the covers, and then that will help you understand what's actually happening. All right, we've got a couple of minutes left. I've got one more demo. Let's tear through it quickly. This is another new feature in 6.1 that almost no one's seen before.
Almost no one? Maybe the person who wrote it?
Yep, exactly. So this is the index attribute. So let's go back over to my VM. And again, we're going to pick on the department thing. And let's say we want an index on this in the database. Like so.
What about clustered indexes?
So you can do that. There's actually a bunch of options in here.
Ooh.
So you get your ordered parameters. So we can give it a name. Give it order. Maybe we should go this way.
Well, you get 6 different options there.
Yeah.
Name order, name parameters. Column order, clustering, uniqueness,
is clustered.
Rock on.
So you can also do multiple columns as well. So if you give an index attribute with the same name across multiple properties in the same type, then it will create a single index with those properties in.
Nice.
All right, so we're going to add a migration. We'll just call this one index. We're going to see migrations will scaffold a simple migration to create an index. So this was possible before. You could write your own migrations to create an index. But if you do that, EF's not aware of them, so it doesn't know to drop them and recreate them when you rename columns.
So you could write that code yourself.
But unfortunately, at that point, the model differ, which works out what to do in a migration, wouldn't be aware of the index, so you're kind of on your own. But now it's in our model, so EF's aware of it.
Nice. That would have gotten you in the situation I was talking about before.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, that's one way to get there. So we'll push that change to the database quickly so that everyone believes me. We'll look at the indexes.
And rating.
You'll also notice we try to do sensible things that users would do, like calling it IX underscore rating instead of IX GUID rating blah.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to make things as close to what you would do yourself.
That's great.
All right.
That's fantastic. You made it through all the demos.
Yes, just. I'm going to pop this slide up. We don't have time to go through it.
But no, that's okay. But make sure you check out github.com/Rowan Miller. You can check out all that stuff. Very generous of you to give us all of that code for the from the Azure Week demo. We're going to take a 10-minute break. We're going to come back as we get towards the end of the day. We've got 2 more sessions. We're going to continue to be more future-looking. Rowan showed us stuff that's not going to ship until April. We're going to see stuff that's going to ship who knows when and talk about the future of ASP.NET and the web and the clouds. Thanks, everybody. Be right back.